George W. Bush is still in denial about the state of the US economy. He said just the other day, quote, with incisive analysis, of course, "We're not in a recession. I don't think we'll go in a recession. We're in a slowdown. And there's a difference." Well, increasingly, I think we have to say, you know, over the last 9 months, all the bourgeois economists who are arguing, oh no, there won't be a recession, all we're going to see is, you know, a necessary correction to market exuberance, very much now they're starting to change their tune, starting to change their story. Just last night, the other night on late night, you know, I saw a number of quite conservative figures, you know, eminent bourgeois economists, you know, promoters of capitalism, starting now to use the D word. You know, they're talking about, you know, a depression. One of them said, oh, Japan was down for 15 years, you know, in a long, drawn-out recession. This is what's going to happen in the US. Even Ben Bernanke, the head of the US Central Bank, the Federal Reserve, told Congress at the end of February, quote, "The economic situation has become distinctly less favourable since the middle of 2007. And in the final quarter of 2007, US economic growth had slowed to a crawl of 0.6%. And Bernanke went on, "Home builders face with abnormally high inventories are likely to cut the pace of building further, which will subtract from growth and reduce employment in residential construction related industry." And at the same time, at Bernanke was talking to the US Congress, the Commerce Department released their latest figures on house building, which showed that the construction of new homes and sales of new homes was down in the US 34% on the previous year. And Bernanke also noted that consumer spending, which in the US accounts for 70% of economic activity, has, quote, slowed significantly, and that investment in equipment and software will be subdued in the first half of 08. And I said, all of this was at the end of January, and this was before the collapse of Bear Stearns, one of the largest investment banks on Wall Street. And you know, you see the scale of it with Bear Stearns. Bear Stearns' share market price peaked at, quote, was it the exact figure, $171.51. That was their peak of their share market price. And they were bought up by J.P. Morgan for $2 a share. And Morgan, J.P. Morgan, didn't want to buy them for that. And the only reason they bought them is that the Federal Reserve loaned J.P. Morgan $30 billion, basically for free, to cover the debts of all the junk bonds and all the other financial trash that Bear Stearns had on its balance sheet, or its various off-balance sheet arms. Now, quite early on, a number of Marxist economists began to argue that what we were seeing now in the US was not just some cyclical recession, you know, the normal part of the business cycle, but a fundamental crisis. And it's worth quoting a few of them to get a feel. Robert Brenner, writing in Against the Current, put it bluntly, "The current crisis could well turn out to be the most devastating since the Great Depression." Well, Fred Moseley, in an article entitled, "Is the US Economy Headed for a Hard Landing?" writes, "The US has been able to maintain a respectable rate of growth in the last three decades, in spite of lower rates of profit, because of the unprecedented explosion of debt financed by an enormous inflow of foreign capital. This increasing dependence on foreign capital raises a very high risk that in the not too distant future, foreign capital and central banks and investors may no longer be willing to lend an ever-increasing amount to the US. If that happens, then the US economy would be in very serious trouble. A comparison with 1929 is alarming." That's the start of the bank crash and the Great Depression. "In 1929, there was very little household debt. Business debt in relation to profit was about half as high as it is today, and there was no foreign debt. The US was then a net creditor, and yet the defaults and bankruptcies resulting from these lower levels of debt were so bad that one-third of banks failed and the Great Depression lasted for more than a decade. And he goes on, what catastrophe would happen with the current levels of debt one can hardly even imagine? If the US goes down, it will take most of the rest of the world with it. The US has been the main engine of growth for the rest of the world in recent years. All this is frightening to think about, but I think there is a very high probability that this is where the US and the world economy are headed. While Joel Geyer writes in the International Socialist Review in America, to pull out of the last recession, the central banks of the advanced industrial countries drastically lowered interest rates to stimulate business activity and restore profitability. The unintended consequences of cheap credit was an international housing boom that The Economist, that's the main bourgeois magazine and economic magazine in the UK, labelled the world's biggest financial bubble ever, and that now threatens to bring about a new recession, much more severe, long-lasting and global. And he goes on, the coming recession will be worse than the recession of the last generation, not only because of the scale of the debt problem, but also because the US appears to have fewer options in dealing with the crisis than it did in the last two recessions, having used them up to postpone dealing with its economic weakness in the past. And I think we're gradually seeing, you know, an emerging consensus about a whole series of economists, not just the Marxist economists I quote, that this could well be the road that the US and potentially the world economy will go down. Now, I would still be a bit more cautious about making predictions. You know, Marxists don't have any crystal ball, and most of the bourgeois economists, you know, just, you know, move day to day with the gyrations of the market and so on, and have got no real appreciation. And one of the elements of the current crisis and the amount of the huge levels of debt in various financial arrangements which have emerged over the last two decades is that nobody knows the scale of the debt. And in that sense, nobody can make a sensible prediction of how things will unfold. So I think we should be cautious, and it could well be another 6 or 9 months until we start to get a real feel for how things work through. But I think what we can say is that there's been and is going to be a serious shake-up in the world economy, and that the idea that's pushed by the boosters for capitalism that somehow Australia and other countries tied to China are going to be able to weather this and even weather a severe US-led recession is absolutely nonsense. The argument that the world economy is decoupled, that somehow countries like Australia are immune from what happens in the world's largest economy, the US, is absolute nonsense and actually cuts against the orthodoxy that the capitalist economists have been preaching for the last 20 years, that, you know, we live in an increasingly globalised world environment, globalised world economy, where everything is intermixed, and where the butterfly effect, butterfly dies somewhere and that sends a wave through the world, can affect everybody. And because we want to see, clearly already, it's not just the US that is affected. Japan, the world's second largest economy, is tettering on the brink of another recession. The German economy, the third largest, is already under stress. In Britain, the financial markets are extremely worried. They're fearful that it can be worse in Britain than in the US. And already we've seen the Northern Rock Bank in England hitting the wall and having to be nationalised. You know, it totally cuts against the ideology of the last 20 years that nothing could be nationalised. You know, the private enterprise, the market could solve every problem under the sun. And the only way the British Central Bank could deal with the situation was nationalise it, because nobody wanted to touch Northern Rock. And it's not just some of the European economies. In Asia, Singapore, one of the boom economies, suffered economic contraction of its manufacturing sector in the last quarter of 2007. But, however, the current crisis unfolds, whether we go into just a mild recession, which some economists still think it will be, or whether we go into a much more severe recession, the reality is that the real casualties of this recession are not going to be the people on, you know, 30, 70, 150 million a year in bonuses. No, they're not going to be the people that suffer. We're going to see a brutal, destructive wave flow through, even if it's a mild recession. And already what we've seen, I think, is enough to demonstrate the barbarism of capitalism and the way, you know, the so-called market works its way through. And the better case couldn't have been made already at this early stage for getting rid of this whole system root and branch and establishing a new social order. A new social order, a social society where production is not, you know, impacted by the gyrations of the market and the debt and debts and so on. Actually, you know, where society and production doesn't occur for profits and so on. Actually, we exist in a planned economy where production is based upon human need, not profit. But how are we to begin to understand some of the current turmoil? A crisis which started in the so-called subprime property market in the US, moved from there to engulf the rest of the property market, then, you know, flowed through the stock markets, the debt markets, hit other banks and financial institutions, and now is starting to hit the real fundamental core of world capitalism, of course, manufacturing industry. And what we see, if we get some understanding of what's going on, we have to move beyond what happens on the stock markets and the debt markets and the gyrations of, on Wall Street. We have to get to understand, you know, what's the basic mechanism by which capitalism operates. And that is, you know, capitalism operates on the basis of a small, tiny group of capitalists, you know, 0.1% of the population, controlling all the core areas of the economy that produces wealth. You know, the mines, the big agribusinesses, the manufacturing concerns, the communication systems, the transport systems, and so on. And it's out of the labour of workers that work in these productive industries, not the people that work in the banks and so on, the workers that work in the productive industries, that it's from that and their exploitation that profits are generated. That, you know, workers in these industries, you know, the capitalists extract surplus value from them. And what do we mean by that? That workers, you know, work 40 hours a week to produce goods, and their pay, and say, in the mines, probably the hours they work, maybe they work in 50, 60 hours, they probably have to work half an hour to cover the cost of their wages. Maybe it's only 20 minutes in a highly productive open-cap mine. 15 minutes, maybe. Maybe it's only 5. That would cover their cost of their wages for the day. And the rest of their time is their unpaid labour time, effectively, goes to surplus value for the bosses. And it is this surplus value pumped out, and particularly these highly productive workers in the most advanced sections of the economy, that fuels the system, which enables the capitalist class, you know, to obviously to buy their luxury yachts and so on, or their, you know, their $15 million, you know, holiday shacks, and that. But much more importantly, it's this surplus value and the profits are gained from it that are used to keep the system running. You know, to reinvest in new means of production, to build up the capital stock of capitalists, and to expand employment. But as well as being an exploitative system like this, that's one part of it. The other part that drives the system, of course, is that the capitalists don't just exploit the labour power of workers. Actually, capitalism is a normatively competitive system. So we have capitalist firms competing with each other at every stage. And it is this process of competitive accumulation that one of the reasons the capitalists have to keep reinvesting in new technology, new means of production, and so on, is they've got to outcompete their rivals, they've got to get ahead of them, or else they'll go to the wall. And it's this process of competitive accumulation that Karl Marx pointed out fundamentally leads to crisis in the system, both long-term crisis and short-term crisis. In the long term, this enormous piling up of capital, of surplus value invested in new machinery and productive equipment and so on, new factories and so on, leads to a long-term decline in the rate of profit in the systems. And that long-term decline in the rate of profit is the thing that leads to major crunches in the system. So, for example, in the lead-up to the Great Depression of the 1920s, the U.S. economy, or the world economy that much, had suffered really from the early years of the 20th century a gradual decline in the rate of profit. And profits had gone down considerably by the early 1920s. And then for 10 years, the system stumbled on the basis of a low rate of profit. And then eventually the crunch had to come. They could have maybe kept it going for another couple of years. And then the crunch came with the Great Depression. The Great Depression was not caused by the Wall Street crisis, the collapse of the banks. That did not cause the Great Depression. Manufacturing industry was always going into recession before the bank collapsed. The bank collapse mirrored and what was going on in the real economy, and in turn, of course, made it a lot worse, spread the contagion through the world system. Okay, but as well as these long-term trends, Marx identified the short-term boom-slump cycle, the so-called business cycle. And what we see there is that, in the short run, in the boom phase of the cycle, as profits are high, capitalists rush to invest in new equipment, new machinery. We see it at the moment, in the mining industry in Australia and around the world, to cash in on the Chinese market, huge productive investments there and so on, more mines being opened up or whatever it is, other boom parts of the economy, the building industry and so on. Actually, massive investment there. Then at a certain point, actually, there starts to be a profit squeeze. There's overinvestment. More mines or office blocks or so on are built. Why? Because, they're all competing with each other. They're all trying to get in first to make the biggest bucks. And that means they tend to build more, because it's unplanned, more mines, more office blocks or so on than they can get a profitable return on. And they get squeezed by other things. Maybe, they get squeezed because you see it in China at the moment, the massive shooting up of raw materials. Prices actually starts to squeeze their profits. Or, it may be the situation that various types of skilled labour, their prices build up, and that starts to squeeze the profits. At a certain point then, profits start to be squeezed, and it can be, the recession can be normally, not always the case, it's but the moment the profits are highest, the peak of profits is usually 30 seconds before it starts to go down in the boom-slump cycle. They peak, and then they start to fall, and then they start to panic. And you see a series of things then. They start to pull back. They cut production. They sack workers. And some of them start to go to the wall. You get the Bear Stearns phenomenon. Their rivals buy them up dirt cheap or for nothing. They can't even give away their factory. Who's going to give away? They're so much in debt. Because often what's happened, the boom and the expansion cycle, not so much in this one because manufacturing didn't quite do it, but often in recession, they expand on the basis of massive levels of debt. And then when things start to ease, it doesn't have to be a downturn at such. The rate of growth slows and they can't meet their debts. They start to go to the wall. Then eventually, of course, the actual process of the boom-slump cycle, the barbaric, destructive process of capitalism, actually restores things. Because, companies go to the wall. Some people survive. The ones that survive cannibalize their rivals, eat them up. Workers are sacked. They're under pressure. Wages are forced down. People are forced to work harder. They're insecure. And the surviving firms start to push up their rate of profit. And the system resumes. The glories of the market work their way through and revive the system at enormous cost, of course. Now, so then it's important to synthesize then the two central features of capitalism. That the system is based upon the exploitation of wage labor of the working class, on the one hand, that's a fundamental thing that provides the basis of the system. And secondly, it's a system of competitive accumulations with all the capitalists fighting each other. And the source of profits in the system, it's really important to emphasise this, underline this, is not the gyrations of the stock and equity and debt markets. That's not where profits come from. Profits come from the surplus value pumped out of workers in productive industries, not in the banking sector or the real estate industry and so on. And it's this surplus value pumped out of workers at the point of production which provides the basis of the system. And all the banks, the debt markets, the real estate agencies, the insurance companies, all the other parasitical sectors of the system feed off and obtain a section of the surplus value extracted from workers in the productive core. So it is what happens in the productive core of the economy that is decisive. And it is, you know, in the ultimate analysis, it's the crisis of profitability in the productive core of the system, which predominantly means manufacturing of the world economy, that determines whether you're going to have a serious slump or not, not gyrations of the market. Now, that doesn't mean to say that what happens on the debt markets or the share markets or, well, the other markets is irrelevant. What happens there often, you know, can have an important impact in that. It can reflect at times what's going on. Not always. Sometimes you can be going into recession and the Wall Street prices are going up. They can be out of kilter. But sometimes debt and share crises can act as a trigger that, you know, if this underlying situation's weak, they can provoke a crisis where there wouldn't have been one otherwise. Now, and that's, as capitalism's developed, the debt, bond, all these sectors, the financial sectors, a very extremely complicated one, has developed, you know, an incredible array and web of financial institutions, which have become quite vital to the functioning of capitalism today. Now, some of these financial institutions, you know, particularly a lot of the SPIV lenders in the subprime sector, are just total parasites. Nothing about it. They're just totally parasitic. But that's not true of all finance capital. There's finance capital, and it's one of the reasons that the industrial capitalists actually allow them to exist, is that they provide certain services for the productive core of the economy. You know, they galvanise, you know, large flows of money, which can be, put together, packaged in means to investment in the productive sections of the economy. You know, they imply important services for productive capitalists. And over the last 20 or 30 years, that this growth of these financial intermediaries have been very important in stabilising the system, given a whole series of problems in the underlying economy. You know, there's been a massive expansion of debt, you know, of unknown proportion. But like the money supply and, if you like, the fictitious mechanisms for creating money are something like 100 times, you know, if you count for real, what it was, you know, 15 years ago. Maybe it's 1,000 times what it was 20 years ago. And it's kept expanding. So there's a huge, massive out of kilter from what actually is being produced to the scale of the money supply, which it's turning over. It's created more. It's not just the sheer amount of financial intermediary. It turns over so rapidly that in a sense. Now, for a period, this can keep the system going and going forward, these huge creative means of creating debt. But can't go on forever. Can go on for 20 years, 25, who knows? But can't go on forever. And we start to see some of that, the fact that these, as well as helping keep the system going, of course, these financial array of institutions, quite complicated ones, also have a very destabilizing effect. And we see that with the subprime crisis in the US. You know, the subprime loans. What were they? Well, these were pretty shonky loans made by a whole series of financial institutions. You know, some of them, you know, sailing very close to the wind.
They were making loans to essentially people that couldn't afford to have a loan. And a lot of that was packaged up by various institutions to the banks. Now, the banks, most of the banks knew these people wouldn't be able to pay back their loans, and that weren't the good stuff. But, and they knew, you know, at least sensible economists in the banks knew some stage had hit the wall. But they felt, because of the competitive pressures of competing with other financial institutions, they had to keep loaning because they could make short-term profits out of it. And if they didn't loan, their share prices would have plunged. So they keep loaning out.
Even though in their heart of their soul, at least the same ones knew there was going to be a crunch. And then the crunch came. You know, for a series of factors, I haven't got time to go into, you know, that the housing market in the US started to go down. And then that swept like a wave. Because what had happened, the banks had folded these loans up into packages, which they then unsold. So, you know, somebody in bloody Cleveland is, you know, unemployed, back working class people, person who they wouldn't even sell a credit card to because they've got a bad debt record, has been given a loan worth twice the level of the price, the house. You know, they can't pay it anymore. They walk away. But these loans are being packaged up. So the same loan can be on-sold 10, 15, 20 times, you know, and some insurance company or superannuation scheme in Finland owns a part of this, but they don't know. They don't know they own a loan or, a, you know, 1% of this loan for somebody in Cleveland and that. And that's the way it worked. And this a massive interweaving of it through all the financial institutions makes it very hard to know which is going on. By last week I saw a figure, the latest figure now, is that the write-offs, the banks have already written off $170 billion. That's what they've owned up to. You know, this is like going to confession, you know, eventually, you know, this is what they've owned up to. But reality is, in most people, in my days as a Catholic, you didn't tell the priest everything in confession. And you know that the $170 million, well, if they're owning up to $170 million, well, billion, well, maybe it's more like $1,000 billion. The real situation. But the really, their value has not just that they're totally lying. They don't know because nobody knows the scale of the debt and what these things are worth. And that's what leads to the crunch. And that's one of the worst features of it. It's what happened to Bear Stearns. See, that because nobody knows what the real level of the debts are or who owes what to who, then everybody's thinking, I'm not going to loan money to them. They won't be able to repay. Bear Stearns seemed to be going great guns. And then one morning, the bank's saying, hold on, we won't give them any money. We don't trust them anymore. And then overnight, boom, the doors are closed. They went down because the other banks didn't trust them anymore. Plenty of companies can be profitable. They can be making big profits. And if nobody will loan money to you and your financial institution, close the doors. And see that that's... And we've seen, you know, smaller scale versions of the same thing in Australia. You know, the property manager, Centro, the shopping centre company manager, you know, they went down, basically. They're still limping along, but their share price crunch, you know, and they've been, you know, everybody's, the vultures are all in picking them. They went down because the bank started to fear that they were exposed because they'd expanded too rapidly, particularly in the US on the basis of very high levels of debt. You know, ABC Learning, you know, the parasites that, you know, live off, you know, persecuting small kids. they went down because they expanded very rapidly on the basis of high levels of loans. You know, and you see it, a whole series of other companies in Australia. And to try to deal with it, the US and European central banks have tried to and have unleashed a huge volumes of credit to try to shore things up. And they've, you know, slashed interest rates, you know, time and time again in the hope that this can start to destabilise. Well, some economists think it does destabilise it. But, you know, the hope that they will stabilise the situation. But we've got to have to be real about this. What's this all about? Cutting interest rates, this is saying to the banks, increase your profit. All these things, the feeling of, you know, JP Morgan have been given $30 billion to handle their debts. Now, actually, the people who really need the money are the people who can't pay their mortgages. They're getting nothing.
But JP Morgan get $30 billion, and so on. So what this is all about, the so-called bailout schemes, they're not fundamentally about shoring up the economy. They're fundamentally about guaranteeing the CEOs of these companies still keep getting their bonuses and making sure the, you know, the top companies don't hit the wall and that their profits are sustained, particularly the banks. And, you know, and what's, you know, the casualties then, of course, are the workers that, you know, throughout America that are just handing in their keys, walking away from their homes. You know, and that's already, you know, so it's a huge human tragedy already in the US, and this is at the very early stages of this current crisis and that. And as the chief executives of these companies, you know, one of the ones that went to the wall in America, he walked away. His company went to the wall, so he drove it to the wall, and then he worked away for termination payment of $70 million. Okay. Now, I think what we've seen already, I think, is sufficient to defy all the rhetoric that has so dominated for the last 20 or 30 years about the glories of the market, of privatisation and so on. That's one of the massive waves of privatisation, of course, is one of the elements that's introduced instability in the system. You know, the idea that, you know, these, you know, financial gurus, you know, the Wall Street traders and so on, they were such wizards and making fortunes out of nothing. You know, all of that already at this early stage has hit the brick wall. You know, all the rhetoric about the market's the only way to run society already is exposed to be utter sham about society. And indeed, a lot of people are arguing now that this could be the end of the neoliberal era. You know, what have we seen? The orthodoxy. You know, the last 25 years or more, institutions like the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, you know, their whole policy has been slash and burn, austerity, cut back government expenditure, and so on, you know, which has had devastating impact on the working class all around the world. Actually, a lot of their rhetoric is now beginning to change. So, for example, the managing director of the IMF, Dominic Strauss-Kahn, speaking at the recent World Economic Forum in Switzerland, that's sort of the club of the super rich, said that not only did the governments need to cut interest rates to try to shore up the economies, but actually there had to be a turn towards greater government expenditure, a heresy compared to what they were saying in the past. And I think that really indicates the degree of nervousness that a whole section of the bourgeois establishment feel about what's going on and that. And because one of the reasons they're so worried is the current crisis is not just a one-off problem. You know, it reflects a much more long-term, problem in world capitalism. That about the degree of profitability of the core centers of the economy. Now, there's a lot of debate about what has been over the last 30 years the ups and downs of the rate of profit of the system. Part of this is because it is very difficult, even for Marxist economists, given on the basis of the figures we release, to work out what the real profit rates are. You know, for some strange reason, the bourgeoisie is not interested in compiling the figures that would help us, you know, have a real scientific analysis of their system. They really don't want us to know this. But so some of this argument is controversial, you know, even amongst Marxist economists. But what most people agree on amongst Marxists is that the great post-war boom was brought to an end by the mid-1970s by a long-term decline in the rate of profit, which led to, you know, a downturn in investment in manufacturing and equipment. And according to one Marxist writer, Robert Brenner, since the 1970s in Japan and Germany and Western Europe, the growth of capital stock, as well as the ratio investment to gross domestic product, has declined decade by decade, and between 2000 and 2005, both of these indicators of capital accumulation were at their lowest level since 1950.
for a period, the Asian boom economies of Korea and Taiwan, Hong Kong and Singapore and so on bucked this trend. But he goes on, but during the first half decade of the new millennium, their level of investment was down by a third. And according to the IMF, investment as a percentage of gross domestic product for the world economy has declined 20% between 1973 and 2004. The result was a marked slowdown in growth in the advanced capitalist economies and a series of recessions that significantly pushed up unemployment. Now, this crisis in the rate of profit led productive capitalists in manufacturing and so on, particularly in the car industry, to in turn move away from investing in their own productive machinery to their own, you know, speculative investment. You know, they fuel the financial bubble because there's more short-term profits to be made there and so on. And tied to this increase in speculative investment in the capitalist class, of course, was an unrelenting offensive against the working class, and which the US, of course, led the way. Now, the US went from being a high-wage economy to the archetypal low-wage economy. Brenner writes, between 2000 and 2005, the increase of wages and benefits per worker in the advanced capitalist economies was at or near the lowest levels of the post-war epoch. The US capitalist class led the way. For more than 20 years since 1973, real wages in the non-manufacturing sector of the US economy steadily declined. This contributed to some improvement in the rate of profit between 1995 and 2000. However, Brenner argues that after the recession in the US in 2001, profits went down again, and the recovery in profits after the 2001 recession was pretty negligible. And couldn't then lead to significant increases in investment to lead to a serious economic recovery in the US since the 2001 recession. Now, the other Marxist economists would dispute some of Brenner's analysis. People like Fred Moseley and Joel Geyer would argue that over the last 5 or 6 years, there was a greater recovery in the rate of profit in US industry than Brenner argues. Nonetheless, despite this argument, because you might think then, well, the people who thought there'd been a greater recovery of profit would then think, okay, there's been somewhat greater recovery of profit in the first period of the new millennium, and that should ensure a degree of stability and of America to ride out the present crisis. Actually, despite that, they share essentially Brenner's assessment of the current crisis. All of them, Moseley, Brenner, Geyer, pretty much all the Marxist economy agree that the US and world economy has entered a profound crisis. Now, as I said, the central banks have tried to stave this off by flooding the debt markets and so on, the financial system, with credit. And that has been the policy they've tried in a number of times over the last 20 or 30 years. And up to a point, it seems to work. But the reality is, in the longer run, this massive inflow of debt, which leads to credit, which leads to a massive piling up of debt, actually just papers over the cracks. And the long term means that when the real crunch comes, and we don't know if the real crunch is going to be, you know, in the current recession, maybe they'll ride this one out, but the real crunch will come at some point, and that this massive explosion of credit actually fuels the problems. And it doesn't, it just delays confronting, for the capitalist class having to confront, really shaking out the system, you know, plunging it. Trevor talked about South Africa, 40% unemployment. Well, that's the sort of levels they need throughout the advanced capitalist countries to really shake the system out, you know, halve working class wages in order to restore the system to profitability and get the system going again. Okay, this is some of the reasons the US is well less placed to use this mechanism massive expansion of credit to ride out the current recession, of course, is now, compared to earlier recessions, the US is much more deeply in debt. You know, you've got situations where there's an enormous US trade deficit. They've spent, up to $1 trillion, and maybe the total bill will be $3 trillion on the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. This gives the US financial system a lot less space to maneuver, to bail out, companies like Bear Stearns. So somebody asked the economist on television the other night, is that, well, if three or four banks like Bear Stearns hit the wall, and bigger ones, well, the Federal Reserve give them $30 billion. They estimate there's probably, I saw some different figures, what the Federal Reserve has got. Well, maybe it's got $250 billion. At some point, it will run out of its cash reserves to bail them out. And it has to do two things then. Print money. They might do that. Some economists are arguing that far from inflation being a problem, we need 20 or 30% inflation. They should print money, because if you have high levels of inflation, that would wipe out the debt and massively cut wages, and more easily cut wages when you've got 20 or 30% inflation. Or what they're going to have to do when the Federal Reserve runs out of its own, assets, of course, they'll go to Congress and demand the American taxpayer, pays the bill. So JP Morgan's and all these companies will be bailed out by taxes and so on. To do this, of course, they can do this, but to do this leads to a potential run on the US dollar. Already, it's under stress. Now, if America has to take these catastrophic levels, you could see a reduction in the price of the US dollar, another 30%, 50% of the US dollar. And that, in turn, would have, who knows what effects on the world financial system. Okay, I should start to wind up. Having said all this, though, I think we're very clear that, the ruling class is far from done. Maybe they can come up with some measures to staunch what's going on at the moment. There'll be some other mechanism they can pull out of their hat to at least limit it to just a mild recession and so on. We don't know. We can't predict either which way. It might be 9 months. It might be 2 or 3 years before we really know what's going on. Maybe they can pull something out of their hat. But already, I think we have to say that in terms of the working class, there's enormous costs being paid. Now, the people who, owned and controlled and ran Bear Stearns, they're just parasites. But as well, of course, Bear Stearns employed 14,000 workers, and 7,000 of them are already lost their jobs and been sacked. And not only have they lost their jobs, they've lost their savings, because they were forced to invest their equivalent superannuation in company stock. That's not worth nothing. Okay, that's just a Bear Stearns. In the car industry in the US, just a month or two ago, before things got really bad, actually they forced through a wage cut where all new entrants into car industry jobs in the US will be paid half the previous level of wages, and so on. This is the sort of measures that are in train. And to impose the cost of their crisis on the working people, to make them pay. Because the reality is, no matter how deep the financial crisis, no matter how severe what happens in the system, actually, no matter how much economic stress, the capitalist system will not collapse of its own accord. The ruling class can survive as long as the working class is not prepared to fight back at the levels necessary to overthrow it. And then, as a final sentence, I think we have to say, well, it is our task then to construct a socialist movement that can start to lead the sort of fight back that's necessary. Whether it's this time round, maybe they can limp through, but at some point in the next 10 to 15 years, that it will hit the wall, and there'll be enormous social costs that the working class of the world will have to pay if we don't get rid of their system. And I'll leave it there.